This is Scott Becker, and it's my pleasure today with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast to be joined by Randy Moore. Randy's with the AANA. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists. We're going to talk to Randy about nurse anesthetists, what they do, shortages in healthcare, healthcare strategy issues, leadership issues, and more in his career. Randy, we'll try to avoid engaging in turf battles. I know it's a constant issue when we at Becker's Healthcare are agnostic between professions fighting with each other, and I know that's not the core of what you guys do, but you do lead up the advocacy and education organization for a 50,000-plus strong profession. Can you introduce yourself?
I'm happy to, and thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate it. So, in short, I'm the chief executive officer. I'm the one and only employee of the board of directors. We have about 130 employees, 54,000 members representing nurse anesthetists all across the country, nurse anesthesia students. So my background is I am a clinician. I am a nurse anesthetist. I've practiced as a nurse anesthetist one way or another since 2005. I'm obviously now out of clinical practice and been in my role for a little bit over 2 years.
Fantastic. Talk a little bit about how your career and how you got from there, it being a practicing nurse anesthetist, to now actually leading the association. How did you get from point A to point B?
Well, I think if you look back at my career, or even you look at my CV, it looks intentional, and it's anything but that. It's been a series of happy accidents and opportunities that I've been successful in taking advantage of. When I went to anesthesia school, I only wanted to do one thing. I fell in love with anesthesia, and I wanted to be a nurse anesthetist. And I would never have anticipated doing anything else. But life happened, and there was something else that I was really interested in, which is leadership. So I moved into hospital leadership as a department director, and then I ran a perioperative service line. I was on the board of directors of this organization, and then through serendipity, and the stars aligned, and I was selected to be in this role. So I do have a really strong interest and orientation towards leadership through management, business, and all of those things. I think just positioned me well to take on this very important position within the profession.
Shortages in healthcare. When I look at our aging population, you know, 325 million plus people are living a lot longer than they used to. The healthcare system is somewhat overwhelmed. There's not enough physicians in lots of places. You constantly are in any discussion you are, do we have the right trained nurses, the right trained anesthesiologists, the right surgeons, the right specialists, the right primary care? Do we have enough of everything? How do you go about addressing shortages in healthcare? And are CRNAs part of the solution to that? Or are they, are they a hindrance? Do they get in the way of doctors practicing anesthesia?
Oh, great question. Well, as you well know, Scott, we are experiencing a pretty significant supply-demand imbalance in healthcare providers. And I would say that clearly impacting the anesthesia provider as well. Well, it's clear that we do not have, and we will not have enough providers to meet the growing need. So we're going to experience a massive increase in consumption of healthcare with the baby boomers. Some people like to call them the silver tsunami. And the supply-demand imbalance is not going to help address that problem, and it is a real problem. And I don't think it's a problem that's getting enough attention. I think if you look at the general nursing population and the supply imbalance that exists and is projected, we get the best and the brightest of nursing. So that's obviously where we get our talent. But even in medicine, you look at the numbers; they're very scary. And so, nurse anesthetists play a really important role in that. That nurse anesthetists are the primary anesthesia providers in rural and underserved America. And we can talk for hours about what's happening in rural healthcare. Obviously, we don't have that time, but it's, you know, we're experiencing, 30 to 40 hospital closures a year, most of which are rural. So CRNAs play a really important role there. I mean, from my perspective, and I'm going to honor your request not to be political, because this is really, these are issues that are being played out at the state and national level, but it really is time for all hands on deck for physician assistants, nurse practitioners, CRNAs, our physician colleagues, and other providers to really come together and figure out how are we going to address these workforce demands, because scope of practice battles is not going to get it done. And so that's what we're doing here.
The medical profession has lots of different hurdles to becoming a doctor. There's in pre-med, there's weed out classes, you know, whether it's physics or organic chem. As you get into the profession, there's it, before you're actually a practicing physician in private practice or as an employee, there is lots of debt. There's years of school, there's years of residency, years of fellowship. Is there room to make that medical school education a little shorter to help address the supply shortage demand issue that we have?
I think yes. I mean, I'm obviously I'm not a physician. I didn't go to medical school. But reading, you know, I try to stay up to speed on what's emerging in medical education. And there seems to be a strong movement towards abbreviating medical school and even changing the way that medical education is provided in order to get more folks, quality folks, obviously, but more physicians into the workforce. And I think that makes sense from my perspective as a healthcare consumer and as a healthcare leader. I think anything we can do to get folks into the pipeline is important. I think the other piece is looking at other providers, as I mentioned, is how can other providers meet the primary care needs and the other acute care needs of patients in this country.
It seems that a lot of the pre-med population in college today, at one time it was doctor or bust. Now it seems like a huge percentage of them, I don't know what the percentage is exactly, but it's at least 50-70% that consider med school or maybe nursing school or maybe nurse anesthetist school or PA school. What does the career path look like for somebody that's going to school as a nurse anesthetist? What does that look like? College and then what happens next?
Yeah, so we, as I mentioned, we get the best and the brightest of nursing typically goes into nursing anesthesia because it's a very difficult and rigorous program, right? And so the program is typically you have a 4-year bachelor's degree in nursing and then you have to do critical care experience. That's average about 3 years. And then you go to nurse anesthesia school, which is about 3 years, a little bit over 3 years, and we'll be graduating all nurse anesthetists with doctorates pretty soon. And then you move into the clinical space and you can do almost anything in anesthesia. If you think about it, you can specialize in pediatric anesthesia, pain management, you name it, which is why I think the profession is so attractive right now is one, you have a good salary, obviously, but two, the scope of practice and the autonomy is pretty good as well. So we work very well with our physician anesthesiologist colleagues. Sometimes we work independent of each other. It just depends on the practice setting and the needs of the facilities in which we practice.
So it's at the end of the day, to be a nurse anesthetist, 4 years of school, then another 3 years of some kind of clinical on-the-job experience of some sort, and then 3 years of nurse anesthetist school.
That's right.
So 28, 30, you're totally at it. But even within those 3 years from 22 to 28 or so, assuming somebody coming right out of college, you're actually working, making a living, and so forth. But at some point, you're going back for school.
That's right. And similar to our physician colleagues, there's a pretty high percentage of our nursing anesthesia colleagues who graduate with a significant amount of debt, which is one of the issues that we're talking about within the profession is how do we support folks who go to school for that long and then graduate with debt that is, you know, similar to a mortgage payment. And I know our physician colleagues are struggling with that as well.
Give me a number on that. So 3 years of nurse anesthesia school, I know the college educations at the private schools, even the state schools have become crazy. What's it cost to go to nurse anesthesia school?
Yeah, it depends on the programs, whether public or private or whether or not you're in-state or not. But I would say the average CRNA new graduate walks away from their training with about $100,000 to $200,000 in educational debt. Now, there's outliers on both ends. I mean, I was an outlier because the military paid for all of my education. And there are outliers where folks who, you know, even their bachelor's degree, they have student loans, so they could be in the $250,000 range, $250,000 in educational debt. So it's one of those issues that, you know, yes, you draw an amazing salary and it's an amazing job and you have a great scope of practice, but it is a significant investment of time and money.
Economics. A nurse anesthetist is making $130,000 to $200,000 a year, something like that. And you could correct me on the numbers. And they're probably for some significant period of time paying $20,000 back a year in student debt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So the average salary right now, and there's variability depending on geography and practice setting and all of that, is about $185,000 a year. Now, because there was a supply demand imbalance, the salaries have gone up 20% on average in the last 2 to 3 years. We've seen 20% salary increase.
So closer to more like 185, I mean, just average. And then out of that, assume they're paying back on $100,000 to $200,000 in debt, $20,000 a year for 10, 15 years, something like that,
right,
to get yourself back to being debt free. And so fascinating, but at least at the salary numbers, you could support some of that debt, even though we'd rather not have the debt. Your own career, when you look at your career, just give us a moment on things you're most proud of and biggest setbacks.
Oh, yeah. I think for me, I think people would expect me to talk about the work that I'm doing now, and I'm very proud of that work and the work that we're doing collectively with the board and the staff, and we're really excited about that. But for me, I would go back. One of my biggest accomplishments and what I'm probably most proud of is providing anesthesia services with Ford surgical teams in Afghanistan, which was my opportunity to give back, right, to contribute and to use my education and my skills in a way that really made a difference. And I think about that a lot, you know, because obviously my career trajectory has taken me a very different place. And I haven't been inside of an OR for 2 years, but I still think about the period of time where I was given that privilege, and the work that team I was with still something I'm extremely proud of, because we absolutely made a difference, and it was absolutely an opportunity to use my skills in a way that, you know, we helped save people's lives. There are people who are walking around right now, are walking around because of the team I was with, and so I think about that a lot.
Let me just step on that for a second, because that's fantastic, and it's one of the great things that a provider, whether it be a nurse anesthetist, a physician, can do that most of us in other professions can't really do. You could plug in and be of great help, whether it's in that case on the battlefield or if it's on the case of just in a poor community or in another country. It's one of the greatnesses of a healthcare profession is there's things you could do that are very hands-on that have great value wherever you are, and it's a fascinating thing. Talk to us and congratulations and thank you for your service. Randy, tell us a little bit about a setback.
Yeah, so I will come back to the role that I'm in now. It's interesting. So I'm a first-time CEO. So this is my first opportunity to lead an organization as an executive. And, you know, I read all the articles that you read, right? I read the books that you're supposed to read about new CEOs and the approach, you know, the first 100 days and what to do and what not to do. And I talked to a lot of folks who have been in the C-suite. And the number one recommendation that I received every single time was don't move too fast. Resist the urge to make change right out the gate. And every time someone told me that, I said, got it, duly noted. I read it in an article, I highlighted it, got it, duly noted. And then I got in the job and I moved too fast. And I made decisions in retrospect which were premature and were a direct result of me moving too fast, even though I intellectually knew that I needed to take time to assess the situation, even let things play out that weren't working in order to get a better understanding of the core issues. And I couldn't resist the urge to tinker. And so, you know, I had some missteps there. And I think that's probably not uncommon with new executives, but certainly when you walk into the job knowing that's an issue and you do it, I think that's, if I had to do over again, I would have moved slower the first 6 months.
Well, thank you. I think it's great insight. And it's this constant challenge of wanting to get things done. Everything we've heard throughout life is that urgency in getting things done is very important to any kind of success, and energy level is as well. So it's hard to check that sometimes, especially when you know, you're a new CEO, you want to put some victories on the board, you want to show progress and so forth, but it's a great perspective from you.
Yeah,
and we appreciate it.
I learned it the hard way, and I think most of us do. It is that having that in perspective. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And you can change things and then regret them because you didn't fully understand what was happening under the hood of the organization. So that's one thing I've become much more cognizant and intentional about that.
And any advice on strategy, either leading an organization like yours or leading a health system, any thoughts on how you approach strategy?
Yeah, this is another thing that, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about is because as an org, you know, all organizations, I think, are struggling with the what I call the tyranny of now. It's not a phrase that I invented, but, you know, I see it a lot and I understand, which is you're caught up in the day-to-day activity of the work that you do. And if you're not careful, it will consume 100% of your bandwidth. So one of the things I talk about with our staff and the board and when I talk to other folks who are in leadership positions, it's about being very intentional about carving out time to think about strategy and protecting that time at all costs. Because if you allow the tyranny of now, the operational issues to encroach on that, you're not going to be moving the needle on what you need to be moving the needle on. And I think the other piece, Scott, is having a diversity of opinion within the organization is really important. And there's one thing that you can't compromise, and that's on talent. You know, you have to have the right people in the right roles doing the right work. And it's the most important and the most difficult part of the job of managing people. But, you know, I've lived it, and I know that you have to have people with diverse backgrounds and diverse skill sets at the table when you're talking about strategy, because otherwise you're just going to keep doing what you've been doing before. And that's really around being very intentional and bringing people into the organization who can be disruptive. And that's what I think is really important, whether you're the CEO of the AANA or whether you're the CEO of the health system, is having a laser focus on bringing in disruptive people and focusing on strategy.
So really, I heard three things there. One is making time to really think about strategy and putting together a strategy. Two is diversity of opinion in terms of who you're talking to about strategy and really developing strategy. And third, and I can vouch for this at your organization, and I will in a second, is talent, is you can't do anything without great talented people with you and a team with you. I know the ANA is focused on talent because years ago, one of the brightest people that ever worked with me, Sarah Chacko, ended up working and going to work full-time with the ANA, and we lost her to you folks a long time ago, but just a wonderfully bright and gifted individual. And I'll take the moment and the shout-out. I know you would be careful to shout-out one member of your team versus others, but I'll take the moment to do so because it's just an incredibly talented person who just is exemplifies what you want in a professional. So those are some of your thoughts on strategy. Intentional, taking the time to do it, great talented people, diversity of opinion. One other thought around leadership, and it might overlap, but any specific advice for leaders? You talked about in your first 90 days, you move too fast, but you want that sense of urgency. But any advice for leaders that you want to share with people today, Randy?
I think I would say never put yourself in a position where you're undervaluing the importance of investing in leadership development. And I'll expand on that just a little bit. Typically, on the altar of tyranny of now and limited resources, organizations carve into or don't focus on leadership development. And if they do, they isolate that to the top levels of the organization, right? So the CEO will get a coach, or they'll bring some leadership folks in to work with the executive team or the senior leadership team, and they completely neglect the middle management of the organization, which is the layer of the organization that actually does the work. And it's really important to understand where your organization needs to go and what the skill sets you need to make it happen. Because if you don't intentionally invest in the development of your middle managers, and it's a term I don't like, but we'll use because everybody knows what it means, is then you're not going to move nearly as fast. And I think every organization that is being disrupted or wanting to be a disruptor needs to have a laser focus on investing in the development of their talent.
That's fantastic. And so the real point is overinvest in your talent, overinvest in their development. If you don't have those levels of management and leadership, you really can't go very far as an organization, because that's really what drives the organization forward. There might be a vision at the top, there might be a culture set at the top, but at the end of the day, you need great people push things forward to make it happen. And if you don't overinvest in those people, you're in a lot of trouble.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it doesn't matter what sector you're in, whether you're in healthcare administration or a nonprofit organization or you're Google. There's a direct relationship between the degree that you invest in talent development and where the organization goes.
Well, just fantastic. Randy, it is a great pleasure to get a chance to speak to you today. I won't ask you the question, who's better, MD anesthesiologist or CRNA anesthesiologist?
I have a good answer.
Please give us the politically correct answer. That'd be great.
They're both amazing. And healthcare in this country needs both.
And both not as fun an answer as though, oh my God, one's better than the other, but clearly the correct answer that both are very badly needed, and our country needs more of both in the long run to take care of our 325 million plus people that's growing every day. Randy, thank you so much for joining us today. What a pleasure to visit with you.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thank you so much, Scott.